area to think that we're almost half through the semester and only done a project anyway.
Yeah, that's really scary.
So,
we should drop those last two.
Yeah, so, I mean, the project two and project three are quite challenging, and so these things cannot afford to not get right to work on those things. I talked some about the ring buffer project last time. Did I show you the test apparatus for ring buffer? Okay, I will do that at the per- I will do that project with your file system just to make sure it works that way. Okay. What I've got here are some executables. FQ.x, FRBuff.x, and MRBuff.x. So let's look at FRBUFF. The versions of these are distributed, these executables. What you have here is a rather hard to understand interface. Let me try to remember it. I think you have three containers. You can put stuff in, push back and push front on any one of the three. They're numbered 1, 2, and 3. The assignment operator, you have to do 1 = 2, and that'll assign the first container, the second to the first, things like that. So I should probably try to put in a little better. But so, for example, if we want to put stuff in the first container, the first ring buffer, we do 1, 1, A, 1. And we would dump number one, and that would show you what it looks like. I showed you this last time.
Yeah, I think you did now.
So I think I also showed you the mrbuf.x operating, which basically just hammers away at three different ring buffers, assigning them and calling all their other operations over and over again, releasing all the memory when they get up to a maximum size that says a constant, which in this case happens to be 1,000 elements, and writes a little impromptu notice when it has to release something, but every 100,000 buffer operations, it also writes a little report. So that's the seventh report. So that's 700,000 buffer operations that have been executed at random here at this point in time. And this is a good little test to see that you're not having a memory leak. Of course, I can't tell if I got a memory leak the way I just ran it, because I didn't set the limit, the memory limit. But, you know, I've tested enough to know that it's not dangerous, so but that you should not do this when you're first trying it out. Always set your limit first. Okay. But if you do have a memory leak, this thing will just blow up, eat memory up like crazy. And, you know, it's virtual memory space in Unix, and so, you know, you'd be into the terabytes of memory very quickly. And what that does is just force the memory managing system to keep paging in and out from real memory to virtual memory. Pretty soon all the CPU's got time to do is page memory in and out. It doesn't have time to do any real work. And that's called, the technical term for that is getting bogged down or something like that. Now, there's a technical term for paging in and out of memory. I've forgotten what it's called. Didn't probably remember taking opposites. Anyway, there's a term for that. I forget what it is. I want to say flail, but that's not quite it. Okay, so that's mrbuf. So what we want to do today then is start talking about Chapter 9, DEX. Stands for double-ended queue. First slide is sort of a review of what we mean by positional, a general positional container. It's generic. It's a generic container that has the property, its name, say, is C, has the property that it's a template class which takes any proper type T. It itself is a proper type. So if T is a proper type, then C bracket T is also a proper type. The example we're thinking about is T is, let us say, a widget, and C is, say, a vector. And then C bracket T would represent a vector of widgets. And you want widget to be a proper type as an assumption, and you also want vector of widget to be a proper type. So there's two different kinds of types here. CFT is capable of storing arbitrary numbers of T objects within the limits of the machine, of course. And CFT supports an associated iterator class, which may have its own name, but it's also alias to the name CFT double colon iterator. That's the name of that type. So something that satisfied all those things is called a generic container. So far we've discussed two of them that are built in your library. One is vector and one is list. You're getting ready to build a third one called ring buffer. In this chapter we're going to talk about a fourth one called a DEQ, D-E-Q-U-E. Now, a positional container is is in a generic container that is more specifically organized and accessible by position. Now, all the containers we have so far are that way, so it's hard for you to grasp the significance of that. But later this semester, we'll be talking about containers that are organized by value instead of by position. So what is a traditional deck? Traditional deck is a double-ended Q-class. And the word deck comes from D-E-Q, double-ended Q. The problem is they didn't spell Q correctly when they did that, so it's all an abbreviation. Q is spelled Q-U-E-U-E. Deck is not spelled D-E-Q-U-E-U-E. It's just pronounced D-E-Q-U-E, spelled. So even the Q-U-E is an abbreviation. Anyway, that's a customary abbreviation for double-ended Q. It's pronounced deck like a deck of cards. Deck operations are the classic deck operations that you can push and pop at either end. So you have a push front and a pop front, and you have a push back and a pop back. Notice that a list satisfies that. Our list class does that, but our vector does not. You can retrieve data from either end with a front and back operation. Again, the list satisfies that. And it's a proper type. Again, the list satisfies that. The assumptions on the element tie are T is a proper type, meaning it has a default constructor, copy constructor, assignment operator. Right, that's the traditional deck. Our deck is going to be the traditional plus. If you open up a classic data structures book, what I just talked about will be a deck. But our deck, we want it to be a generic container for one thing, and therefore it's got to have an iterator class associated with it. So it's going to be the traditional assumptions plus the following non-traditional additional assumptions. Push front, pop front, push back, pop back, and empty. All have constant runtime, at least amortized, and run space no more than their size. So. So right away you see that even though it would be possible to add a push front and pop front to vector, functionally you could make it work by playing a leapfrog game in the vector, but you couldn't make it satisfy this constant runtime. So that's why it didn't matter. Okay, the second, so that's a assumption that is not made traditionally, because traditionally people didn't make any assumptions on data structures. There were some very cumbersome and slow data structures around in the old days. Second modern assumption is this random access iterators class associated with. Now all of a sudden we're really in a quandary, in a mystery here, because we've ruled out vector because you can't do push front and pop front in constant time. This now rules out list because you can't do a bracket operator, a random access iterator with a list. Not remember that part of the definition of a random access iterator is that the bracket operator runs in constant time. If you were willing to let a bracket operator run in linear time, then you could build one for a list. It just wouldn't be a good idea because you'd be slowing down thousands of client programs all over the world with your library. So we got, of course, all iterator operations are supposed to have runtime constant, run space constant. So at this moment, we don't have a container that satisfies these conditions. So here's our implementation plan. It's the classic, and this is a classic, circular array implementation. The way this works is you have a protected array. We'll call it content. And it'll be of size, content size. And what we're going to do is maintain the illusion that content of content size is equal to content of zero. So notice that what this does is maintain the illusion that the vector is circularly configured. Allow it to draw a picture. So, of course, our vector, well, our array, rather, sitting here, it's got element slots 0, 1, 2, out through content size minus 1. And what we're going to do is take this really non-existent element, content bracket size, and equate that with, in our modeling, with the zero element. So in the machine, obviously that's not happening, but if we do that in our model, this is a model kind of rather than actual program. You have to implement this model the way you have by carefully implementing the deck. But we can now draw pictures of this deck by drawing these elements arranged in a circle and indexing around in that circle, being at 0, 1, 2, so on around, finally coming back to S minus 1. And then when we went to S, we get back to 0. So this is the illusion we maintain. Since I'm standing up here looking at the picture, let me point out how this illusion facilitates the push front and the pop front operations. So what we got to do is maintain, remember in a vector, we have to maintain a separate piece of information that told us where the end of the actual data was in our vector. Well, in the deck, we're going to maintain two pieces of information. Both indices, and they're going to be the beginning index and the end index of this in this array. So when you create a deck, it starts up, it has no elements in it. So you can do something like push back elements and you can push front elements. Let's say we push back the elements. We push back let's say A, B, and C into this deck, and the raw array will presumably begin and end start out being equal to 0. And we're thinking of the begin through up to but not including end being the range in which our deck is stored. Okay. So the model is that the range begin, comma, end squared off square bracket begin and round bracket end. That's the range. This is the actual deck data. So we push A into the front. That's then in the circular picture it would go here, and our end index would be changed from 0 to 1. Push B to the front, it would go here, and the index would go 2. Push C to the front, the end index would go to 3. The begin index is still 0, so I've got A, B, C, and my begin index is 0, my end index is 3 at this point. Now suppose I push front sometimes. So let me push front X, Y, and Z in a word. Well, the front and if you look at it, you know, in a straight line, the front is off here to the left of any of my data. But one index down from A is index minus one, which is, since zero is equivalent to S, minus one is equivalent to S minus one. So that's where we put the new data. And we push front, it's right here at S minus one, in this instance. So what did I say, X, Y, and Z? So we'll put X, and that ends up going right here in the circular picture. And we have now a new front and a new begin index. And that's, instead of being zero now, it's now S minus one. Okay, so that was X, and we do a Y and a Z. Push front Y and Z, and picture begins to look like this. And what that push front operation, every time I was decrementing the begin index, so that takes it down from S minus 1 to S minus 2 to S minus 3. And my deck still is from begin to end. So I got the deck, if you output it from a client perspective, it would look like X, Y, Z, A, B, C. And so that's how push front and push back and push front work. Now, pop back and pop front, you can guess now how they work. Pop back is going to be essentially decrementing the end iterator, the index. And pop front is going to be incrementing the begin index. And all this works fine until this thing kind of meanders around the circle to the point where the zero index is between the you're not using the zero index, and then it begins to look a little weird because if you think about it, that will mean that the begin index is bigger than the end index. But you got to remember that you have this illusion you're maintaining here. And so as long as you maintain that illusion, and if begin and end are, you know, in the wrong relation to each other, that means you need to add S to M before you do it, before you can reason about it correctly. And everything works fine. So begin and end are really numbers modulo S, is really the way to think of it. You're doing modular arithmetic on these indexes. So that's kind of the key idea of implementing the circular array implementation of a DAG. Now it's clear too that you can make a bracket operator because the raw data is stored in this content, in this array called content. Now that's a private array, of course. And so then you've got the content bracket operator. So you can do the content, that's your private array. And you can put in there, in that bracket, any number between 0 and, so which range of values is 0 out to S minus 1, out to size minus 1, or out to size with an open ended interval there. But that's the private thing. What about the deck index? Well, the deck index clearly should start with the begin thing. So deck index 0 element in the one we just built on the board here is Z. That's the index, that's the deck index 0 element. And Y is the index 1, X is 2, A is 3, B is 4, C is 5, and the index 6 is one past the end. And so the external deck index has to be translated to the internal array index in terms of doing arithmetic with the begin index and the end index and the parameter that gets passed in. Again, it's basically just arithmetic mod S. So the deck bracket I has got to look like content bracket it should be begin plus I. Accept it. I'm sorry, begin, it should be begin. What am I saying? Yeah, that's right. Begin plus I. Got it right. Except this begin plus I, you should think of that as being addition modulo S. So it's begin plus I, unless begin plus I is bigger than S, in which case it's begin plus I minus S. Really one or two possible values. And that helped that. So it's begin plus I with the circular thing, illusion maintained. So that gives the deck itself a bracket. Now, then the implementation then of the deck is just all the push front, push back, pop front, pop back operations have to just maintain this illusion. There is now distributed in our class library the tdeck.h that you can use that has this particular implementation of the deck. Now, how would we do iterators here? When we didn't really talk about iterators with vectors. We hadn't really introduced the concept at that point. We didn't really need them at that point. But now we probably should go back and talk about them. A vector, if you look in the vector distribution in your library, you'll see that the vector iterator is, at core, just a pointer. So it's really just like an array iterator with some operations defined in its public interface. And those operations are really pointer arithmetic operations. So we're not going to be able to do that with this implementation of deck. So a deck iterator. The problem is with a deck iterator is you can't just raw iteration in the underlying array is not the same as iteration as a deck of. With a vector it is. So you can use a pointer into the raw array for a vector iterator, and pointer arithmetic for that pointer is equivalent to the pointer arithmetic for the iterator. And that pointer bracket 5 means the same thing that you want the vector bracket 5 to mean, the iterator bracket 5. It sort of doesn't, it's harder to make that work with a deck because of this skew that we have, this structural but hidden from the client view. So the client won't know, you know, what particular skew the deck implementation has at any given moment. It'll depend on push-pop history of that particular deck. It's exactly what Mesquite is. Mesquite meaning how this thing is racked around in this imaginary circle. So, what we do for a deck iterator is maintain the knowledge of which deck we're pointing to. And use the deck bracket operator to define the deck iterator bracket operator. So let's say we have a deck iterator. The deck iterator would start out, of course, being equal to the beginning of the deck. Let's say it's I here. And if I dereference I for this deck, of course, it would end up returning the Z value, which is right there at the front of the deck. And I, if you like, bracket 0 would be the same thing as the deck back bracket 0. So that would be I. It would be the same as deck bracket 0, which in our case here would end up would translate all the way down to content bracket again plus 0. In fact, deck bracket, the I bracket little I or I bracket k would be the deck bracket k, which would be the content bracket begin plus k, remembering that begin plus k should be interpreted modulo size. And so now then, what would it mean to increment this iterator? If you increment, remember an iterator can be incremented. So what is, if I have this iterator begins at the beginning of the deck and I plus plus it, it will now be pointing to the one element instead of the zero element. And so, how do I take that into account in this picture? The problem is I don't have enough information to take that into account, so I need to add some data to the iterator. So, at first I said the iterator will have a pointer to a deck object that it's iterating. The next thing the iterator has to have is an index value that's its own current offset relative to the deck index. That index value will start out being 0. But if I do a plus plus I, then that'll make its offset index owned by the iterator equal to 1. And so if I do that and then do I bracket k, that'll be the same as the deck bracket k plus 1. Which will be the same thing as the content bracket again plus k plus 1. And in fact, I'm supposed to be able to do pointer arithmetic here. So I could add, let's say, add m to this iterator. Let's go back and start a new iterator j. Let's let j be equal to deck dot begin. And then I'm going to do j, then I'm going to do I equals j plus some other integer, and I'll call it m. Now I has an offset of m. And so I bracket k be the deck at k plus m, which would be the content at k at begin plus k plus m. All arithmetic interpreted mod size. Well, the content thing interpreted mod size. deck of K plus M, if K plus M is bigger than the size of that, you would call that an invalid. So if I equals J plus K, J plus M rather, and then you do I bracket K, if K plus M is more than the number of elements in the deck, that's an invalid index for that particular. So by the time you get out to the iterator level, you've got two different offsets you're working with. And both have to be taken into account in the DAC implementation and in the DAC iterator implementation. Of course, the client never has to worry about this. As a client programming device, this DAC works just fine. Indexes mean what they should. Point arithmetic works correctly. And you even have the nifty property that if the deck gets bigger than its footprint, it has to double its footprint. The iterators aren't even become invalidated because part of what the iterator has is the address of the deck that it's pointing to. So it can go, so it gets to the deck data through the deck itself. And so if the deck itself changes the address of its data, then the deck will know that. So this is a kind of a smart iterator, smarter iterator than the vector iterator we have. By the way, you can go back and make the vector iterator smart, too. In the standard template library, it's not stated whether or not the vector iterator is smart. So the vector iterator may be a pointer, like we did, or it may be a little smarter, like the one we built today. And you don't really know that. And you can't depend on it being one way or the other for a given implementation of STL. So, that was a long-winded explanation of the implementation plan for the deck. The size of the deck is the n minus begin modulo content size. Like, I'm not sure I said that explicitly, but that's not surprising, is it? It's n minus begin. If n is bigger than or equal to begin, then the n minus begin is the size of the deck. If n is less than begin, so that difference would be a negative number, then you have to add content size to get the size. The bracket operator model on that for t vector, and we discussed that. The iterator implementation plan, start with the public interface of a list iterator, add a bracket operator and pointer arithmetic, that's your public interface. Protected, you're going to maintain a pointer to a specific deck object, and a deck index value, which is the actual element to which the iterator points, or rather the index of the actual element to which the iterator points. So our deck public interface is just about what we said it would be. You've got a first of all, you have the usual terminology support, the value type, and iterator are two things that have meaning in the scope of a deck. As a default constructor, a two-parameter constructor is like the one that vector has. That you can set the size and initialize it with a constant of t, a constant of type t, and it has a copy constructor, has a destructor, has an assignment operator, has a bracket operator, empty size, push front, push back, pop back, clear, which makes it empty, and that's going to be kind of like the vector clear operation, where we're just going to clear, just needs to set and April Began. That'll make the make the anti-Martian return true. Got a front and a back accesses. Got iterator support, Began and R Began R end. Began returns an iterator to the beginning of the deck. And returns one past the end of the deck. R Began returns one to the actual last element of the deck. And R end returns one past the beginning. One past the beginning and the decrement side of the deck. And as usual, we have display and dump functions associated with deck. And the classic circular array implementation. You have a content array, and you've got three size type integers. Content size is the size of the content array, and begin and end are the two cursors that we've been talking about in the model. And we're going to load the output operator, the equality operator, and the non-equality operator. The iterator, basically that's exactly the same public interface that the vector iterator has, and it's almost the same as the list iterator. The only difference is that we have a bracket operator and pointer arithmetic added that we don't have for the list. And this illustrates that we're going to have a pointer to a deck object as well as an index value, and those two together will define an iterator into a given deck. So the Q pointer data item here is the address of the deck to which your the iterator is pointing, and the index is the index of the element in that deck that the iterator is pointing to. So when you increment a deck iterator, you'll be incrementing that index value. When you have the begin function for a deck will return its address for Q pointer and zero for index. That'll be the beginning iterator for a deck. Somewhere in the narrative here, it's a long discussion here in the implementation plan, in the narrative. Well, that's the implementation plan for the iterator. Implementation plan for the deck itself. I've got a less impromptu and more carefully thought through example of watching a deck grow. It starts out with a footprint of 20 slots in it, and grows from nothing in it all the way out to 'fill up its footprint. It goes out far enough to turn around that sort of imaginary glue point where the end is back to the beginning. It kind of shows you how all that stuff works. So the implementation, this is actual code. Most of this you could easily do. Let's talk about the assignment operator just for a minute. It's typical of assignment operators. You first check to make sure it's not a self-assignment by checking the address that you are with the address of the incoming object. Assuming it's not, then you have to get a new you have to ask for some new content to hold the data for Q. And then you have to check to see if you actually got that content. I apologize for these weird little formatting things on these slides. I think that's being caused by somehow Emacs is putting in tabs when I used to have spaces. And browsers, different browsers have different interpretations of what a tab is supposed to look like. So formatting's not cutting out quite right. And I apologize for that. So anyway, if you got your new memory, then you delete your old memory and copy the data from the incoming deck to the memory you just got. Notice that we waited until after seeing if we got the new memory to delete the old memory, because you'll see here that if this memory allocation fails, this particular idea for implementing the assigner operator doesn't crash the program. It just sends an error message. You notice that not only does it not crash the program, but it also doesn't mess up. It doesn't change the left-hand side, the L value. So we waited to make that delete call after we knew that the memory had been allocated. If the memory isn't allocated, you never make that delete call. Well, wait a minute. Yeah, because there's a return statement right there. Let's see. So the bracket operator, notice here's you got this integer comes in, that's the client's integer. You add that to begin, the internal parameter begin, BEG. And then you've got to see whether you've overstepped the outer right-hand limit of the content array. If you have, then you got to subtract the size of the content array, and that's the internal index of the element. Push front and push back are simple, with the one exception of, just like for vector, you might run out of footprint, and you have to, if you do, take a timeout and make a new footprint, copy everything over from the old footprint to the new footprint, and go back to business. And of course, you got to do that for either push front or push back in a deck. But except for that, there is just a matter of copying data over from one place to another. You have to be a little careful how you do that, because you know you're going to get twice as much footprint as you had before. And so, particularly in the case where the circle begins and ends in the middle of your deck, you have to be careful how that works. So the point being that, well, the simple way to take care of that is just have the new deck restart the new deck with no skew in. The skew is just an internal property anyway. So when you have to double the footprint size, you got to copy all the data anyway, and you copy it so that the skew is set back to zero, and that just keeps the logic simple. Push back, almost identical. Pop front is just like for vector. I'm sorry, pop back. Vector doesn't have pop front. Pop back is like for vector. You decrement in vector, you decrement size. Here you decrement the end. Pop front is you increment the beginning. So you move the beginning up one notch. Of course, we don't have that for vector. talking about the deck iterator. Everything is completely straightforward except the business about the bracket operator. Well, you might want to look at valid. You say the deck iterator is valid if, first of all, it's not valid if its pointer is zero. So if it points to the null deck, then it's invalid. And then you say it's invalid if the index, that index there is the one owned by the iterator. Index bigger than or equal to the size on the deck that it's pointing to, then it's invalid. Neither one of those is true, then you say that it's valid. Here, two iterators are going to be declared equal if they point to the same deck and they have the same internal index offset. The reference, first check for validity. This does a valid validity check. But first, it checks to see if the Q pointer is zero. If it isn't, then it checks to see if the size of the deck is zero that it's pointing to. And failing that, it just calls the bracket operator for the deck that it's pointing to with its own internal index as a parameter. So that aligns with the picture I drew on the board. The star I, or I bracket 0, is equal to the deck at the index of the iterator. Increment an iterator by incrementing its index. Of course, the postfix increment is always make a copy of yourself, increment yourself, and then return the copy that you made before you increment. Now, I just want to find the bracket operator. So the bracket operator takes the client's index I. First, you check to see if you're pointing to a valid non-zero deck. If you are pointing to a valid deck, then you call the deck's bracket operator at the internal index supplied by the iterator plus the index supplied by the client. That gives you the equivalent of that pointer or that iterator bracket operator. Stop me if you have questions. So that's DEX. Kind of a neat implementation. It's need to be very careful. The thing you have for project two, the ring buffer, in a way might remind you of this stuff we're doing with DEX because we're making circles. And it does have a few things in common, but the problem is with the ring buffer, we're making those circles out of dynamically declared memory with links, whereas with the deck, we're making it with memory declared in a big block, like a vector. So the ring buffer, in that sense, is more like a list. But it's, on the other hand, more like a deck in the sense that it doesn't. With a list, whenever you delete an item from anywhere in the list, its memory that was allocated to it goes away at that point. So the memory allocated to a list is always an exact constant times the number of items in the list. But with the ring buffer, once you allocate space for something, then you keep it rather than deleting it, regenerating. And so, in that sense, it works sort of more like a deck than a list. And the way, and these, you have these two pointers in a ring buffer that's the first used pointer. And that really is playing the role of the begin index for this deck, circular array information deck. And you have the first free pointer, which is playing the role of the end index for a deck. So there are some analogous things going on in the logic of it, but it, you just have to be careful that in the actual implementation, the way you're getting the memory for things and dealing with it is very different from the way you do it with a circular array. And one of the things I didn't mention is that the deck does not have a couple of things that, that are special for vector. Set size and set capacity. You don't have those with a deck. But the only way you can make a deck have size bigger than zero is to push something onto it. You can't just set it to have a certain big size. But you can set it to have a certain footprint with a constructor. But that's the only chance you get to set its footprint size to. That can be, you know, there's a constructor parameter that allows you to initialize a deck to be a certain size. But that, again, is going to make the size of the deck big as well as its footprint. And so to get the size back to zero, you'd have to pop it size times from either the front or the back. So about the only time you set a vector, about the only time you declare a deck to be anything other than size zero is when you already know exactly how many elements you need to put in it, because you might be copying them from some other structure or something like that. Okay, so now enter chapter 10. Abstract data types. What is an abstract data type? Well, here is our definition. This is a better definition than the one you find in most textbooks. It consists of really three things: a collection of data, some operations on that data, or on subsets of the data, and some axioms or rules of behavior that govern the interaction of these operations. The principal examples we're going to have of abstract data types are stack, queue, list, vector, deck, priority queue, table, map, associative array, set, graph, and diagram over the course of this and the next 4531 course. That's pretty much... those are pretty much the abstract data types we're going to be talking about. What we're going to do is introduce fairly formally in this chapter stack and queue. We've already seen implementations of list, vector, and deck, and we'll talk about what it would take to make those into abstract data types, and we'll decide if it's worth it. But we'll certainly want to be convinced that we could if we thought it was worth it. The advantage of stack and queue are two. The first advantage is that they predate electronic computers as data structures and as helpers for computational tasks. So they have a history that goes all the way back to the beginning of computation, machine computation. And they're still widely used to describe all kinds of things: stacks, algorithms, parts of computers, and so on. The other advantage, other than the fact that they really are intertwined in the history of computing and computer science, is that they're simple. And so we can talk about them and really get down to the nitty-gritty of what they are as abstract data types without the evident complexity that you would have if you were dealing with something like a list whose public interface is somewhat enormous. You might go back to the definition there, and that might be reminiscent of the kind of things you see in math courses. It's fairly common to describe things in math this way. For example, a group. A group is a set of elements with an operation that is assumed to be satisfy certain rules. Number one is has an identity. Another is it's associative. I think that's about it. Every element has an inverse. So that's a group. Rings have two operations in math, plus and times. So kind of the real numbers is kind of the archetypical ring, if you like. So in math, these things happen all the time. You have sets of things, you have operations defined on them, and then you give axioms and you prove theorems about these structures based on the axioms. Even set theory is like that. So, anyway. Let's talk about the stack abstract data type. I'm going to talk about what is the collection, what are the operations, and what are the axioms. The collection is going to be some elements of some proper type T. The operation is going to be push, pop, top, empty, size, and a constructor of bstruct. Notice that push takes, in some way, a parameter of type T, whereas pop doesn't. Notice that top takes a parameter but returns a value of type T. So the way this is, the model for this is, push T is supposed to put T on to, if you like, the top of the stack. Pop removes the top element off the stack. Top tells you what is the front element without changing the stack at all. So it doesn't take it off, it just tells you what it is. So the axioms are empty, size, and push are always defined. Pop and top are defined if and only if S dot empty is false. Empty, size, and top do not change the stack. So in C++ parlance, those can be const operations. Empty is true if and only if the size is zero. Push of T followed by pop leaves the stack unchanged. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that pop removes the last previously pushed item from the stack. And six is after a push, top returns the thing you just pushed. So to put that another way, top returns the item that was pushed last onto the stack. S dot push of T increases size by 1. S dot pop decreases size by 1. And that's enough axioms. And with that set of axioms, and maybe paring it down a little bit, you could prove a theorem. The theorem would be that any two stacks for type T are equivalent, are mathematically equivalent. So you could that means that you can have a one-to-one correspondence between their elements, such that if you do an operation on one stack, do the same operation on a different stack, the result is the stacks are still in one-to-one correspondence. So as a term for that in math, we say that any two stacks are isomorphic. As usual, I have some discussion in the narrative, which you might want to look at. It should serve as some notes for you. So here's the intuition behind the stack. It's the so-called LIFO model, last in, first out. In the old days of computing, this wasn't called a stack. It was called a LIFO. That was the name of it. So here's an empty stack. That's the picture we draw. Notice over here I've listed a few factoids. S dot empty is true. S dot top is not defined. S dot size is 0. Then I do an S dot push of A. That puts A on the stack. S dot empty is now false. The top returns A. The size is 1. If I push a B and a C, then I get this picture and those factoids. And if I pop after those three pushes, notice that C, the last in, is the first out. So that's the stack. It's hard to believe that would be very important. It's so simple. Here's some theorems you can prove. If the size of the stack is n, and you push k times, then size will return n plus k. That's not a surprise, is it? But you obviously could prove that with the form being mathematical induction, the form of the proof. There's another one. If size is n and you do k five operations, then the new size is n minus k. And as a corollary, you can't pop more than k, more than n times. Because it's, remember, an error to pop an empty stack. Uses of abstract data type stack. Here's just a few. It's used to control the depth-first search algorithm and backtracking. It can be used to evaluate postfix expressions. It can be used to convert infix expressions to postfix expressions. Let me just take a moment here and make sure you know what I mean by infix and postfix. Let's just talk about arithmetic expressions for the moment. Infix is where the operation occurs between the two operands, like normal human arithmetic. And since that's normal human, that also happens to be what high-level languages like C++ and Pascal and Java and all those use. They use infix notation. Postfix notation is where first comes the operator and then the operands for it. Some of you may have seen calculators that run so-called reverse Polish logic. That is postfix notation. It has the disadvantage of being somewhat counterintuitive for people that are used to infix, which most people are, but it has the distinct advantage of being a parenthesis-free syntax. So you do not need parentheses to determine the meaning of a postfix expression. It turns out that if you look on this list here, you can evaluate postfix expressions with a stack. And it turns out that that's the way computers do it. So therefore, it also turns out, since high-level languages use a lot of infix expressions, that computers have to have a way of converting infix to postfix. And that's a translation process that's done in software, as in when it's compiled. So in your object code, your expressions are going to be postfix expressions. So we'll talk more about both those things in a minute. Another interesting thing is the runtime stack. You may have heard just vague references to the runtime stack. Well, it turns out that the way C, C++, Java, Fortran 2000, Pascal, I can't think of any other languages right now, but all the modern languages use a runtime stack. And this is, here's the way a runtime stack works. Well, I'm going to give you a picture of it, so let me wait a second. And finally, the notion of recursion. Recursive programming is supported by stacks, namely the runtime stack. So we're going to look at these in a little more detail later. But let me go back and tell you what a queue is first. The abstract data type queue. The elements are some elements of some proper type. Operations, we'll call them push, pop, front, empty, size, and constructor, destructor. Notice that the only thing that even is a different word is the front from the stack. You look in a book, other books use different terms. What you call these things, of course, matters nothing. What matters is the axioms. And queues behave differently from stacks. Some of these axioms are the same. So the queue size, empty, and push are always defined. Pop, front are defined only when the queue is not empty. Empty and size and front don't change the value of the queue. The queue is empty if and only if the size is zero. Those four axioms are exactly the same as they were for stack, except we change what we call it. Number five is a little, this is where it starts behaving differently, and it's a little hard to state this in a succinct way, but let me try. Suppose you have n, a queue of size n, and suppose that the next element pushed on the queue is 2. Then, after exactly n elements have been popped from queue, t is at the front. So what that means is that every element that got pushed onto the queue ahead of T comes off the front first. So for this reason, queues are called FIFOs, F-I-F-O, first in, first out. Push increases the size by one, pop decreases the size by one. T equals Q dot front, then Q dot pop removes T from the queue. So really the basic difference in behavior between a queue and a stack is this axiom 5. Here's the queue model. The queue model is much more convenient to lie out sideways than it is to make it up and down like a stack. In fact, it's going to be convenient later to draw stacks sideways as well. But I gave you the vertical picture first because of the image of stacking things. So here's an empty queue. You see, there's nothing there. That's how you know it's empty. After you push A and push B, you get A at the front of the queue and B at the back of the queue. Then if you push a C, and a D, you got still A at the front, B next, and then C, and then D. If you pop the queue, A comes off the front. First in, first out. So A was the first in, it's the first one out. Pop again, B comes off, and so on. So they can't go in on one end and out on the other. So your ring buffer project that you're getting ready to work on is really effectively a queue implementation. So we could have just as easily called those operations push and pop instead of push back and pop front, and even the terminology would be more Q-like. But in fact, if you looked at the axioms, you'll see that the ring buffer's behavior is exactly the same as any other Q's behavior. And so you're making a Q. Derivable behaviors for Q is similar to those of stack. Let me mention a couple. If the size is n and you do k push operations, then the size is n plus k. Obvious sort of fact, but something you got to admit is true. And go on. The first element pushed onto Q of those still in the Q is the front of Q. That's not exactly the way I stated that similar thing to stacks. I tried to make it a notation-free version of the thing I said for stacks. Of course, it's a slightly different thing I'm describing. Right? Anyway, pi removes the front element, and so on. Q's are also ubiquitous in computing. Buffers are made out of Q's. Your stream buffers, your stream objects, in the I/O system, C++, are all Q's down underneath. Q's are used as controllers for the breadth-first search algorithm, and they're used extensively in simulations, which is still an important part of all kinds of applications. All right, so let's go back and talk about some of these things in more detail. What do we mean by depth-first search and backtracking? What I have here is a picture of a graph. I've got the red vertex as a start vertex, and the problem is to find the green vertex, the goal vertex. Now, if you are a critter who can't see above the level of the planar surface of the screen, a two-dimensional figure, then of course you can't see a solution to this thing. An analogy for you as humans would be, suppose this is a cave complex and you're spelunking. And your food and oxygen is over there at the green dot. So, how do you get there? Well, the depth-first search way of finding that location is to explore. You got to decide on your own. Am I going to make selections left to right? Let's just agree we'll do that. So we start at the leftmost way to get away from where you are. That will be you're here. The leftmost road out would be this road going to 2. And you keep exploring down paths until you have nowhere to go. And then you backtrack. We first would go to 2, take the left out to 5, take the only way out to 6, take the left out to 8. 8's a dead end. You backtrack to 6. 6 has another way out, but it doesn't. It takes us to an already explored location, so we don't go that way either. Back up, there's no other way for 5. Back up, there's no other way for 2. Well, I'm sorry, 2. There's a right-hand path, but it takes you to a place that's already been visited, so you don't go there either. So you back up, that takes you all the way back to 1. So that was inducing perhaps a certain level of anxiety. You're all the way back to where you started, you didn't find your food. Right? Then you take the next path. That takes you to 3. Take the left choice to 9. Take the left choice to 7. That's a dead end. Backtrack. There's another choice out here, so you take it to 12. It's a choice out to 12. There is a, did I say left or right? The left choice out of 10 takes you down here, and sure enough, that takes you. way that you would control that with a stack. I'm going to have a stack here. I'm going to grow it horizontally instead of vertically now. It's just easier to draw the pictures and everything. But here's a stack. The stack is going to be, I'm going to use it. So what I'm going to do is push something on the stack when I'm there. So I start at 1, the starting location. There's the stack. I've got 1 on it. Then push 2 on it. Then I push 5. Then I push 6. Then I push 8. This is all the way out to here. At 8, I dead-ended. I backtrack to 6. At 6, I've got no places to go that haven't been explored, so I backtrack to 5, backtrack to 2, backtrack to 1. So that whole little search of that branch of the cave system that's fruitless is represented by that portion of the stack growing and shrinking. So this is the same stack all the time. It's growing and shrinking. Then I put in, I'm back to 1. I try the next branch, which is a 3. Go from 3 to 9. Go from 9 to 7. 7's a dead end, so I backtrack back to 9. That's a pop of the stack. Backtracking is pop. Going forward is push, by the way. Back and going back is pop. So everything is either a push or a pop operation on the stack. You push 7, pop 7. Then you push 12, then you push 10, and then you push 11, and you discover that 11 is the goal. Not only that, notice that the contents of the stack is a path that will take you directly there. 1, 3, 9, 12, 10, 11. 1, 3, 9, 12, 10, 11. Now, I didn't say it was the best path. It's just a path. This is in a way analogous to the way, you know, a human way to do this would be if you're in a maze and you've got light, you can see, then you take, I don't know, some flour or some lime or something white, and you just sprinkle a trail behind as you go. And that means you can always backtrack, right? You sprinkle a trail where you go. When you backtrack, you leave the trail there. So that'll tell you where you've explored and where you haven't. When you come upon that on another attempt, you obviously know, well, I've been here, so I don't want to go there again, and that makes you backtrack. What is breadth first search? Breadth first search is actually very different. The model for breadth first search is not an individual rat finding its way around in a maze. The model for breadth first search is you've got a committee of rats, shall we say. And what you do is every time you reach a branch, a branching break the committee up into subcommittees. You send one subcommittee down each branch. So we start here at the red vertex, and there's three possible directions, so we take three subcommittees and send one down each branch. That's step one. This is kind of parallel processing. Step two, all the subcommittees are now at a new place. You give them, so they look at their choices, and break up into committees and explore one layer further down. Now, assuming you have enough people or rats, this will work. Right? Eventually, one of those will find, if it's possible to get to find the green, then one of those will find it. But that's kind of the search mechanism, intuitive. That you can control with a cue. And here's a picture of a cue, and here's the way that cue would control it. Now the cue, one of the things that makes this a little harder to understand is that in fact, even though it's clearly a parallelizable kind of thing, we still have to do it sequentially. So this is sequential. So what we do, the rule of thumb here is, here's your cue. You always push the immediate, the unvisited locations adjacent to where you are onto the cue, and then pop the cue. So my unvisited adjacent locations were 2, 3, and 4. 2, 3, and 4 got pushed on, and then I popped the cue, which took one off. So after pushing 2, 3, 4 on and popping, I get that picture, 2, 3, 4 on the cue. And then I look at the new front. The front of the cue is 2. So for 2, I push all the reachable unvisited locations onto the cue, which is 5 and 6. And I pop again, so 2 goes away. That leaves me with 3, 4, 5, 6. 3 is the front of the queue now, so I push the adjacent unvisited locations from 3 on the queue. That would be 9 and 10. And then I pop the queue, taking 3 off. Now, always working from the front. 5 is now the front, so I push the unvisited locations from 5 onto the queue. But here's 5. 2 and 6 have both been visited. So 5 has no unvisited locations that it's adjacent to. So there's nothing that gets pushed on, but 5 gets popped. 6, ditto. Here's 6. There's no place you can get from 6 that hasn't already been visited, so nothing gets pushed on, and 6 gets popped. 9 has 7 and 12 that haven't been visited as adjacent locations. There they are, and then we pop 9 off. 10 has a location, 11, that hasn't been visited. Push it on and pop. At this point, the queue has 8 in the front and then 7 and 12 buried and 11 in the back. At this point, since you can't access, and often you can access the front and the back of a queue, you might say, be smart enough to stop the search at this point. But you don't have to. You can keep doing the same algorithm, and eventually the solution is going to come off the front of the queue. So the algorithm would then, from 8, it's kind of degenerating itself anyway, because from 8 there's no place to go, so you just pop. From 7, there's no place to go that's unvisited, so you pop. From 12, there's no place to go that's unvisited, so you pop. So all those just end up being pops anyway, and then you're left with the goal at the front of the queue. So we'll start off with the start location pushed onto the queue, and we ended up with the one item in the queue, which is the goal. Now, this particular algorithm isn't quite as nifty as depth-first search in one sense, because in depth-first search, the contents of the stack actually was a solution was a path from start to go. That isn't stored in the cube here. On the other hand, if you follow this algorithm, and if at each stage you left, whenever you got to a location, put up a little signpost saying where you came from. Just which road, you come to one of these nodes and there's three ways to get out of the node. You put a sign pointing down the one that you came in on. by that simple expedient, if you did that, then when you get to the green node, you would have a sign pointing you to the place where you came from. And when you got there, there would be another sign pointing to the place where you came from, et cetera, all the way back out to the starting location. So with that expedient, what that finds for you not only is a solution, but it finds the shortest solution, the most efficient path. You recall the path we got using depth-first search was longer than it really needed to be. It kind of wandered around this way and came down to 13 and up and back. So it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paths long, whereas the more efficient one is 1, 2, 3 paths long. And you can find that by that technique of leaving a little information, like I said. And your next project after this one is called the Rat Pack. And it's going to be, you're going to be simulating a rat's solving a maze using the committee method, basically. So you're going to do a breadth-first solution of the maze problem using a queue controller for the algorithm, the search algorithm. Okay, more stuff you can do. So that's two neat things you can do, one with a stack and one with a queue, right? Depth first search and breadth first search. And by the way, those are extremely important algorithms that are implemented for graphs to solve all kinds of problems on graphs that have truly heavy significance and practical applications. I won't go into it any more than that. Anyway, coming back to Earth here, remember I said you can use a stack to evaluate a postfix expression. Here's how you do it. You've got a postfix expression. It consists of operands. That precede the operator. The operands precede the operator. I think what I described a few minutes ago was prefix. This is postfix. Prefix, you have first the operator and then the operands. Postfix, you have first the operands and then the operator. So here's the evaluation algorithm. It's actually simple enough to describe with a hand waving. You got a stack. It's going to be a stack of tokens. The token here will be defined to be either an operator or an operand. Turns out, in this algorithm, you really don't need to push operands anyway, so you could just think of a stack of, say, numbers. What you do is this. You're reading this expression. Every time you get to an operand, you push it onto the stack. And every time you get to an operator, you pop. When you get to an operator, it will require a certain number of operands. Pop just enough operands off the stack to give to that operator. Let it compute, give you a return value, and then you take that one value and push it back onto the stack. You keep doing that until the stack's empty. At that point, well, you keep doing that. The last item popped off the stack is the result of the evaluation. Let me do that in on the board. So let's see. Suppose we wanted to do 4, 5 plus 6 times 2 plus 3, 5 times plus. So that's 4, 5 plus 6 times 2 plus 3, 5 times plus. That's the expression. You store it in a cube, by the way, a buffer. So we look, take the front off of the cube, look at it. It's an operand, so we put it on the stack. I'm going to draw my stack vertical. Got 4. Look again at the new front of the cube. That's 5. That's another operand, put it on the stack. Look at the new front of the cube. That's plus. That's an operator, so I pop just enough things for plus, which would be 2 things, add them together, and push that back onto the stack. So that makes the stack 4 and 5 have been popped off, and 9's been pushed on now. 6 gets pushed on. Star, you pop 9 and 6 off, multiply them, push the result back on, you get a 54. 2 gets pushed on, and then the plus. This isn't a very fun example. 2 plus 54 is popped off, and that leaves with 56. Now 3 gets pushed on. Now it gets a little more interesting. And then 5 gets pushed on. I see a multiplication, so I pop 3 and 5 off the top of the stack. 56 is still buried down there. 3 times 5 is 15 as a result, and it gets pushed back onto the stack. Plus is now there. I pop 56 and 15 off the stack, add them, plus them, and you get 71 pushed back onto the stack. Pop, and, well, that's now the bottom, and that's the top of the stack, and it's now the solution. the result of the evaluation of the expression. And you just got a hint in this example of how you actually need a stack and not just 2. It looked like we wanted to get by with just 2 memory locations, but you need expandable memory because, you know, you can stack up all the operands. I could do something like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1. And then I could do a plus, times, plus, times, plus, times. So that would look like, this time I'll draw the stack horizontally. Push from 1, then a 2, then a 3, then a 4, then a 3, then a 2. One. I put my stack and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 items on it. Pop and add give me a 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 3. Pop and multiply give me a 1, 2, 3, 4, 9. Pop and add give me a 1, 2, 3, 13. Pop and multiply give me a 1, 2, 39. Pop and add gives me a 141. Pop and multiply gives me a 41. And that's the result of the evaluation of the expression. Now, this is pretty handy. It turns out that in modern CPUs, there's a hardware stack for precisely this purpose. There's a hardware implementation of a stack on the CPU in the computer you are using. And it is used down at the machine level to evaluate postfix expressions, just like these. When you read the specs on a CPU, if you look at the fine print somewhere in there, it'll tell you how big the stack is that it used to support expression evaluation. And that can be an important number. Clearly, if you overflow that stack there, now of course there'll be a software fix for that. So if you overflow the stack, it won't make the computation crash, but it will make it slow down big time. So computational science type people always want to know the size of the stacks that are used to support. And they just want to make sure that they don't ever have expressions whose complexity is such that it would overflow the computation stack during the run of the program. So here's another example of evaluating a postfix expression. This one is 1, 2, 3, plus 4, star, plus 5, plus. And there's the stack. You can follow it. Here, the expression you can think of as being sitting in a queue, push a 1 on the queue, push a 2 on the queue, push a 3 on the queue. So there's a 1, and then a 1, 2, and then a 1, 2, 3. Then there's an operand plus. So that plus takes the 2 and 3, pops them off the stack, adds them, and pushes 5 back onto the stack. And I come across a 4. 4 gets pushed onto the stack. Now a star takes the 5 and 4 off, multiplies and pushes 20 back on. Plus takes 1 and 20 off and adds them and puts 21 back on. 5 gets pushed, plus pops 5 and 21, makes 26 and puts it back on, and that's the result. Okay, the second big example I talked about was stacks. One of the examples, anyway, was the runtime stack. Now, here's the way that works. When you're running a program in C++, here's the way that program runs. The start of the program is to push function main onto the runtime stack. That's always the way a C program starts. The stack is set up in the software, in the memory that's been allocated to the runtime for your program, the run space rather for your program. You can think of the stack as growing from the lowest memory location you've been assigned upwards, if you like. What you push onto that stack is so-called activation records. And these are like little objects that contain just enough information for everything to work right. So when you push a function onto the stack, it will contain the name of the function, it'll contain a place to return to in the code when that function returns, and it'll contain places to put the input parameters, and it'll contain the address of the actual code to execute that function. So it'll just contain the address of the code, not the code itself. So it'll just be a little data object. The second rule is, whatever's on top of the runtime stack is the function that's currently running, currently active, under call. So the first thing that happens is function main gets pushed on, and as long as the stack is not empty, the program is running. Main will call other functions, and their activation records will get pushed onto the runtime stack. When they return, what they do is they have the address of the calling location, and they send back that gives them a place to send back their computed value if there is one. And then when they finish, their activation record is popped off the stack. Notice that activation record contains the local variables for that function, which is why when they're local, they're really local. Because when they pop off of that stack, they're gone. They're not just unavailable, they're gone. Okay. So that's the way that works. The runtime stack grows and shrinks with the function calls of your program. And the final thing is when function main returns, it pops off the stack, and that makes the stack empty, and that's the termination of your program. So when you do a recursive programming, that's where a function calls itself. What that's doing is making an activation record of a function, which gets pushed on the stack in another cycle or two. Another activation record with different parameters, but for the same function, gets pushed onto the stack. And the machine doesn't care whether it's the same function or a different function as records getting pushed on there. So it's just a natural consequence of the runtime algorithm is that you can do recursive programming in these languages. In fact, it's sort of more fun to do order two recursive programming, where if you've got a function f that calls a function g, and you got a function g that calls a function f. And that's, it doesn't care. If it had a rule that said a function can't call itself, you could get around that rule by having a function call g and having g call f and do recursive programming that way. So once you got this system, they can't take recursive programming away from you. And as I said, you can think of that as growing, let's say, from left to right, from low towards the high end. So you can sort of think of your execution environment. Let's say the relative address for your execution environment, let's call it 0. 0 plus whatever your lowest address assignment was. So let's just call it 0. So relative address 0, from there up, the first thing you do is stack in all of your executable code for your different functions and some other stuff like that. Static. The knowledge that you have to have during the run of the program. Then you would build your runtime stack on top of that, and then you would push function main onto the runtime stack, and boom, your program's off and running. And the addresses of all the code it needs are already stored down below where the runtime stack began. And by the way, there's an upper limit to your memory assignment as well. Well, at least there is when you type limit. When you type limit 20,000, that's 20,000 K bytes of memory you want, and that's setting your upper limit of memory to 20,000 relative bytes, relative to zero offset. What happens to that upper end? The way to think of that is that's where your heap is. The heap, this has nothing to do with something we'll call heap sort later. Just for some reason, the same word has been used for it. But that's the place where dynamic memory is allocated. So if you call operator new, it's going to take memory from the upper end of this fixed allocation space and let you use it. Of course, as you allocate memory up there, the unallocated memory, the address of, where the unallocated memory ends is shrinking down as you allocate memory from high address space. In the meantime, of course, your stack is growing up. Now, if these two things ever collide, it's a core dump city. So that's, and the core dump will give you basically the addresses of everything in that whole memory location. All the memory you were executing. That's what the core dump is. The precise state of every memory location you were assigned when the program quit working. Now, it works a little differently from that when you have virtual memory. But in principle, that's the way it always works. An adapter class is a way to do the classic HAZA in object-oriented programming terminology. Basically, what an adapter class does is just change the interface of another class. And you can talk about the adaptee and the adapter, but let me just give you an example. We're going to implement stacks and queues as adapter classes. So here's what the stack and queue adapter requirements are going to need. The stack is going to need pushback, and it's going to use that to define push, and it's going to need a popback, and it's going to use that to define pop. It's going to need empty, back, and size, and that's what it's going to use to define top, empty, and size. The queue is going to need a pushback to define push, and a pop front to define pop, and a front to define front, and an empty to define empty, and a size to define size. So here is a complete implementation of stack based on a container that's a template parameter. Notice that I'm passing in a type name parameter T and a class whose parameter name is container. That's just the name I'm choosing for the parameter. And what you do is you give yourself a private, or I said protected, doesn't really, I could have just as well said private, container object C. Type def T the value type. There's an implicit assumption that T and C value type are the same. And here's how you do it. I'm going to implement these operations right here in line. So, for example, push, I will take an element x, and I'm going to call c dot pushback of x. And by the way, notice the other technical things. I'm passing that in as a const reference. And that's typically the preferred way to pass parameters in when you don't know what the type T is, because you're guaranteed that a reference isn't much different in size from a pointer or an address. So it's at worst something like an unsigned integer, probably an unsigned integer. The type T might be, you know, considerably bigger than that. And of course, if you happen to do it with care, you're wasting space, because you put a char in there by value, it'd only be 1 byte instead of 4 bytes. But there are ways to decide whether or not you should do it by value or by reference. Anyway, that's just the way you're passing it. And eventually, wherever I am here, in this pushback, presumably, I mean, it's up to the container C to figure out how it does this pushback, but you can assume that at this point, a copy of X is being made and put in that container. And what we're saying here is that there's really not much point in making a copy of X here just to hand it to this so it can make another copy of X. So we're passing a reference to the X that you want a copy of. This calls pop back for the container. Top returns c dot back, empty returns c dot empty, size returns c dot size, clear calls c dot clear. There's our stack. It's completely implemented. All we got to do is find a container C that has those operations, and we're cool. Well, vectors have those operations. Lists have those operations. And in fact, decks have those operations. And so we can substitute a list or a vector or a deck for that parameter, and any one of them will make us a queue. I'm sorry, a stack. This is the way it's done in the standard template library. The standard template library also puts a default value on the container. The default container for stacks is, what would y'all guess it would be? It's a good guess, but it's not right. deck. And let me tell you kind of why it's a deck. A vector, because it's closest to the metal, is going to be the fastest. Vector is also the least safe. Most vectors are implemented with just barely disguised pointers as iterators. And that means that vector, you know, references iterators into vectors and things like that are become invalid after pushes or pops in that vector. Now, that's not, so deck doesn't have that problem. Deck iterators continue to work. But the problem is, we don't really make iterators for type stack anyway, so it's not, I'm actually kind of on a fishing expedition as to why that choice is made. But nevertheless, for whatever reason, that is the choice that's made. We're getting ready to look at a Q adapter class, which looks very much like this. And the Q, the default container to use for Q is also a deck. Anyway, that's a complete implementation. Of course, it depends on being able to find a container that supports the operations that you're calling. Okay, we're going to do the same thing for a queue. Notice that we just, the subtle differences are pop is pop front, whereas it was pop back for a stack. And there's a front operation instead of a top operation. And the front operation pulls the front of the container, whereas the top operation for a stack pulls the back of it.
Different. We just did a queue for a consistency between these two.
Maybe. So here's examples. Here's some examples. I think I'm a narrative. I actually have some. Yeah, some code. This is sort of showing you how to declare let's not try to look at it there. We'll look at the actual code that's distributed in a few minutes. So here's code that's distributed for your enjoyment. There's a functionality test for stacks and a functionality test for queues. I've also distributed an environment where you can test the performance of these things. How fast is the stack? Well, a queue race would be how fast is a queue relative to which container you base it on. So you can make a queue list, or queue out of a deck. You're eventually going to be able to make a queue out of a ring buffer. And you can sort of set up a freeway speed race to see which one of those is fastest. S race does a similar thing for stack instead of queue. And this, the apparatus I set up for that is there's something I call the drag strip, which just allows you to take two things, run them both, and see which one finishes first. Track of time. And these things are also going to use random object generators that are distributed in XLAN. So we'll talk about that software as soon as we get an opportunity, which would be during our lab today, as soon as we clear up issues and past projects. And finally, there's converting infix to postfix. Remember, that's another thing I said you could do with a stack. and this would be something that would be done in software as part of a translation from high-level code to low-level code. So how do you take an infix expression and convert it to a postfix expression? Well, that turns out to be a little more complicated algorithm than the evaluation algorithm that we talked about earlier. Evaluating a postfix expression, the one that's typically implemented in hardware, is a simpler algorithm than the one that does the translation itself. What I have done is codify that algorithm in actual C++ code here for you. And we can sort of talk about that. Notice that the input is a queue and the output is a queue. So the reason I like this is we're going to use queues and stacks in the same algorithm. And they're queues of tokens. And like I said, a token is going to be an operator or an operand. First thing we do is make sure that the output queue, that's going to be our output queue, Q2, make sure it's empty. We're going to use a token stack as a local variable here, so it comes to life empty. Now, I've used the term token queue and token stack here. Those are just type defs above this function. There was type def, and I believe those are included in the narrative description of this. Yeah, there's tokens defined in the narrative. And there's the type defs. A CQ based on, I happen to use list, of tokens is called a token queue, and a C stack based on a list of tokens is a token stack. Okay. The token is a type, and a token queue is a queue of that type, and a token stack is a stack of that type. So what you do is you've got to operate as long as the input queue has got tokens in it, right? Because that's where your expression is stored. And the one thing that makes this complicated is you got to deal with parens. So the first thing you do is see, well, is the next token a paren? We're going to push it on to the token stack if it is. If it's not a paren, then you see if it's an operator. If it's an operator, then you're going to check its precedence. Operators have precedence. So if the operator's precedence, as long as the operator's precedence is less than the precedence of the operators at the top of the stack, you take the top of the stack, send it to output, that is to say, take s.top and push it onto Q2, which is the output. And take it off the stack. So that while loop got rid of all the operators that were on this stack that had precedence bigger than or equal to the precedence of the one you just discovered in the front of the input queue. And all we did is just send them to output. Then we push the new operator onto the stack. And of course, take it off the input queue. Okay, next is the possibility that it was a closing paren on the input queue. If you have a closing paren, you're never going to put it on the stack. What you're going to do is pop the stack until you find the thing that it mates with that you pushed off the stack earlier. And you pop that stack, regurgitating it right out the output. As soon as you find the mate to a paren, you take everything off the stack and send it to the output until you get to the mated paren. Then you pop it off the stack too, and you throw them both away. You won't need them anymore. And finally, you might get an actual operand. So far I've dealt with all the operator possibilities. If you get to an operand, then you just send it to output. Now, one thing you might notice is that means that in this algorithm, operands never make it onto this stack. Only operators and left parens get onto this stack. This is the control stack. And you keep doing that until you run out of things, and then in the input, and if there's still stuff on the stack, you just flush the stack out and send it to output as well. And that's the end of the algorithm. So what I'll do in a few minutes is show you that algorithm in operation. That's my excuse. Well, that's a pretty good day of pretty good week of lecturing here. We've covered DEX, which is one more nice container class, and we've covered abstract data types, stacks and queues, but also not only what stacks and queues are, but how to build them with adapter classes, and some really pretty nifty uses for stacks and queues. And when you start looking around, now that you are aware of stacks and queues, you will find them everywhere. They are extremely important and ubiquitous in computing. Communication would be impossible without queues. My machine must send your machine some data across the internet or the local network. If your machine sets up a queue for me to put stuff into, that's the way that works. Your machine had to play catch with my machine in real time for each data item. We'd never get anywhere because it would require that we have notions of time that are identical, and that's not possible. So if the only way your machine can play catch with my machine and have it actually work is if your machine attempted to do nothing else but wait for my data, and also nobody else tried to send anything to your machine, so it had to put itself in a state where it couldn't be interrupted, then it might work. It still would require that your machine can receive my data item and do something with it, and then get its glove back up ready for another data item before I send the next data item. So it better be fast. So obviously that's not practical. So if machine-to-machine communication would be impossible without a queue to receive the data. So what the queue does is give me a way to shove the data to your machine at whatever speed is convenient for me and allow it to build up in a queue. And then your machine can access the data in that queue and deal with it at whatever speed it finds convenient until the queue's empty. Every time you run a program, you're using a stack, a runtime stack of the program. So, in a very real sense, you can't do anything in your personal computing environment. You cannot do anything without using essentially both stacks and queues all the time. So let's take a leg stretching break and come back and talk about project.